to Amandla Radio, your weekly broadcast with news and analysis about and from the continent of Africa. This week we will be playing a webinar put together by the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute and moderated by Bianca Mugeni. And they are focusing on the fact that the largest mining conference in the world took place on this past Monday in Toronto. And on the eve of the planned protest against the meeting of the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, Bianca moderated Canadian Mining in Africa, Looting a Continent, a webinar. They also gave people access to a film called We Call Them Intruders. This is a film about Canadian mining in Africa, which the filmmakers have made available to the community of the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute free of charge. You can go there and see if you can still access it. I'm not sure. But We Call Them Intruders was conceived, shot, produced, and birthed into its final shape by the formidable team of Tamara Herman, who was a longstanding contributor to Amandla Radio, and Susie Porter-Bopp, based out of Vancouver. Go take a look and see the ugly reality on the ground and how it connects to the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, which annually puts on its gaudiest tributes to rapacious exploitation of the environment and much of that in Africa. Thanks to the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute for pulling this webinar together and giving voice to what Feroz Manji calls amputation, not extraction. Once you take it, it is gone forever. The panelists are Filia Nguache, from Mining Effective Communities United in Action, Makua in South Africa. Jamie Neen, another contributor, regular contributor to Mining from Mining Watch Canada. And Eve Engler, author. We thank them for their support and their good insights to what is going on in the collaboration with the Canadian government.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to everyone at home. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks for joining us. Today's webinar is titled Canadian Mining in Africa, Looting a Continent. And we have a great lineup today. We're joined by Filia Nguache, Eve Engler, and Jamie Neen. So welcome to our guests. It's such a pleasure to have you here. My name is Bianca Mugeni. I'm with the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, who are the host and organizers of today's event. And you can find out more about our work at foreignpolicy.ca. And the Institute is based on the traditional territory of the Ganiangihaga people and the keepers of the eastern door of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. We also recognize the continued presence of the Métis, Innu, and Inuit people on this land. So I want to thank our co-presenting organization, Mining Watch Canada. You can find out more about their great work at miningwatch.ca. So, again, my name is Bianca Mugeni. I'm here representing the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, which is an organization that challenges unjust foreign policy measures and aims to bridge the gap between the perception and the reality of Canada's role in the world. We also work to challenge the racism that's embedded in our foreign policy. So the CFPI is completely reliant on donations from our community to keep on doing this work. So please do consider donating or becoming a sustainer. And you can do that at foreignpolicy.ca/donation. So for today's event, we really started thinking about it after reports surfaced around the eight miners trapped below ground at the Pergoa zinc mine in Burkina Faso. And at the time, we saw a tweet from Kay Diallo, who said, open quote, for 20 days, eight African miners have been stranded more than 500 meters deep in a zinc mine operated by a Canadian company in Burkina Faso. Why on earth isn't there more outrage on this? Or is solidarity just a privilege that remains for those who live in the West and are white? So an important question that was asked. We know that Canada is a mining superpower in Africa, and that the Trudeau government has aggressively backed companies, even when they're responsible for significant human rights abuses and other abuses. So the Trudeau government, for instance, supported Canada's most controversial mining company, Barrick Gold, in Tanzania, which is the country where Barrick Gold has committed its worst mining abuses. And while we didn't plan this, the timing of this event is precipitous. We are on the eve of the largest mining conference in the world, which begins tomorrow in Toronto. It's the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada Conference, and it's expecting around 20,000 delegates. And so there are actions planned around this. The Mining Injustice Solidarity Network is organizing a protest to hold corporations and governments accountable for expanding mining without community consent, regardless of its impact on the environment, regardless of its impact on people's lives. So you can find out more about how to participate in that. The link, I'll be putting the link to that in the chat, as well as the links to all of the excellent organizations that our speakers are with. And so with that, it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker of the evening, Jamie Neen. Jamie leads Mining Watch's strategic research and communications, mining policy development, and individual mining projects in Western and Northern Canada. He also leads the organization's advocacy in Africa, as well as on mine waste management, mining and Indigenous rights, uranium mining, and environmental assessment policy and practice in Canada. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you, Bianca. And thanks for the opportunity to be here. I want to start off talking more generally about mining in the Canadian role, and then I think get into some more specifics. But just to say, to start off by saying that the mining industry, both the mining corporations and the governments that support it, present mining as a driver of development, and now increasingly as a savior in the climate crisis. So supplying massive amounts of materials for the renewable energy transition and allowing economic growth and corporate profiteering to continue unhindered, as if we were not in the midst of multiple crises of biodiversity, of pollution, of inequality, and as if increased extraction will not itself also exacerbate the climate catastrophe. But just like many Canadians, African leaders at all levels have bought into this pernicious myth-making, sometimes willingly as partners in corporate corruption or as supporters of colonial structures, sometimes under immense pressure from international financial institutions and the ironically misnamed donor governments. But while large-scale mining can indeed generate exports and foreign exchange earnings and provide employment, albeit at decreasing levels, and not to mention dangerous and underpaid, it also creates massive and often permanent social and environmental disruption and damage. And thanks to international investment and taxation agreements and the use of tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions, even government revenue from mining often fails to meet expectations. Because it represents a loss of irreplaceable, non-renewable mineral resources, mining, therefore, represents a drain of wealth from the African continent, part of an overall transfer of wealth to international investors and former colonial masters that far outstrips the aid and investment provided by wealthy countries. And in terms of Canadian investment, one-fifth of Canadian mining investment outside the country is in Africa. It is not evenly distributed, although there is some investment in most countries of the continent. But just as mineral wealth and mining activity is not evenly distributed, Canadian companies extract mostly gold across West and East Africa, copper in Zambia, copper and gold in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and platinum group metals in South Africa. Oh, and coal. And, the mining industry is highly concentrated and capital intensive. So while there are hundreds of small junior mining companies leasing mining concessions and drilling for minerals, barely a handful of big operations account for a large part of the total investment. And maybe I can share the slide. Can you see that? That just shows the geographic distribution of Canadian mining investment. And I'll put some links up afterwards for where that comes from and the data. That's the Canadian government figures. So, there are hundreds of small junior mining companies leasing mining concessions and drilling for minerals. There are barely a handful of big operations that account for a large part of the total investment. So Ivanhoe has big investments in the DRC and South Africa. First Quantum Minerals is a huge player in Zambia. Barrick Gold operates in Tanzania and the DRC, and a number of other somewhat smaller companies mine mostly gold across West and Central Africa. Canadian companies, as I said, are present in most countries of the continent. But the explosion of Canadian mining interests in the African continent is relatively recent. Since about the mid-1990s, Canada has worked with the World Bank and the IMF to restructure the mining industry in countries around the world to favor foreign, and specifically Canadian, investment. Mining codes and relevant laws have been rewritten as part of IMF structural adjustment programs or as World Bank loan conditions to reduce taxation and environmental and labor protections, facilitate the repatriation of profits, etc. And at the same time, Canada has enthusiastically negotiated multilateral and bilateral investment treaties or free trade agreements that contain investment provisions. All of these measures directly or indirectly restrict governments' ability to act to protect their own people, their own economies, and their own lands and waters. Using investor-state arbitration, companies can and do actually sue governments for millions and sometimes billions of dollars if they are not allowed to proceed as they wish. Now, mining companies are hardly shy in building relationships and lobbying foreign governments, but the Canadian government also directly supports Canadian mining companies in everything from basic permitting processes to negotiating taxation and lease agreements, often intervening at the highest political levels and regardless of how Canadian the company really is. Interestingly, as soon as allegations of human rights or environmental abuse surface, government officials are quick to point out if the company is headquartered elsewhere and maybe not really Canadian. And Canada even has a state corporation, Export Development Canada, or EDC, that provides billions of dollars in loans, loan guarantees, and political risk insurance to companies without any meaningful public accountability. So when we look at the mining sector globally, we see an industry that extracts mineral wealth for the benefit of investors, producing commodities to supply wealthy consumers and militaries. In keeping with the power concentrated in governments and increasingly in the financial sector, mining companies enjoy active government support to establish and expand their operations and create impunity for their abuses of human rights and the environment. And the Canadian mining industry, meaning both Canadian corporations and the Canadian government, plays a much larger part than Canada's modest population and economic clout would suggest. The figures vary from year to year, but something like 75% of the world's several thousand mining companies are Canadian, about 60% trade on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and at least a third of global mining finance is done in Toronto. Now, I alluded earlier to the economic, social, and environmental disruption that large-scale mining causes. And I think it's worth noting that these impacts are often more severe in many African cases than in other parts of the world. And this is partly due to weak democratic governance in the post-colonial period, exacerbated by structural adjustment, austerity, and neoliberal deregulation. Even where regulations and political will do exist to protect water supplies, workers' health and safety, and communities' health and livelihoods, there is inadequate capacity to do so, and governments may be further constrained by investment agreements and political pressure, for example, from the Canadian government. Another factor is population, in the sense that many parts of the continent are occupied by subsistence farmers and pastoralists, as well as artisanal or small-scale miners, who may also be farmers. So large-scale mining often not only compromises people's water supplies or access to land, but actually forcibly relocates entire villages and even districts. Barrick Gold's Bulyanhulu mine in Tanzania forced at least 200,000 people off their land and possibly up to 350,000 with no compensation or accommodation. In other cases, people are relocated to model villages. And astoundingly, despite decades of experience, these new villages continue to be built without taking people's needs into consideration and without providing them with support to ensure that they continue to have access to water or farmland, for example. And so just to mention some of the cases that Mining Watch has been working on over the years and examples of the kind of thing that happens. I mentioned the Bulyanhulu mine in Tanzania. It's actually one of the first cases that MiningWatch started working on in 1999 when we started up, because the relocation had taken place in 1996. The mine was established and the literally bulldozed people out of the way. As I said, something like 250,000 people were forced off the land to make room for the mine. And 52 people, up to 52 people were allegedly killed and allegedly buried in their own small-scale mines by the company's bulldozers. And I have to keep saying allegedly because the case has never been proven in court. The affidavits that lawyers were collecting from the survivors were stolen. There was considerable intimidation, and the police commissioner who was in charge of that operation was quickly promoted. So it's been, we have to keep saying allegedly, otherwise we're defaming Barrick Gold, and that's something that you really don't want to do. But the brutality of that operation, I think, speaks to the reality of mining, not just in Tanzania and not just with Barrick Gold, but similar, if slightly less gruesome cases have happened in other parts of the continent and in many countries. And as I say, in places like Ghana, Burkina Faso, people are still being forced off their land to make room for Canadian gold mines. In Tanzania, also Barrick Gold opened its North Mara mine, not too far from Bulyanhulu, in 2002. And also didn't even try to relocate people get people out of the way before they started building the mine. They just started building the mine. They started fencing off land. They started digging and bulldozing. And the displaced people and the villagers who've lost their farmland are now called intruders because they are forced to survive by scavenging bits of gold from the mine site. And they often suffer routine and often deadly violence from mine security and the police, shootings, beatings, rape, as part of their punishment for trying to make a living essentially off their own land. And throughout this, the Barrick has enjoyed, I think, really deep support from the Canadian government, the Canadian High Commission. Most recently, there was a very strong attempt by the Tanzanian government. And this Tanzanian government had tried several times to rewrite its own laws and regulations to generate more revenue from mining, to try and capture more of the revenue as royalties and taxes. And the Canadian government has assiduously and insistently participated in intervening with the Tanzanian government on behalf of the company to defend it from having to pay more tax or more royalties and to defend its reputation. I could also talk about Ivanhoe, another Canadian company operating the Ivanplats mine in South Africa. But I think Philia is going to talk about that in just a moment as soon as I stop talking. And there are other cases I could talk about. First Quantum in Zambia, which was a partner with Glencore in some of the most polluting mines in Zambia. So these are major copper mines and smelters that actually had imported the scrubbing equipment to bring some of the contamination out of their air emissions, and didn't bother installing them, despite legal action by residents and so on, people getting sick from the pollution. There's a few other cases there as well involving attempted land grabs on the part of the company, trying to corrupt local chiefs and so on. Another case in Ethiopia where it was discovered that Canadian mining companies and the Canadian government were very interested in what was happening in Tigray, because there are a lot of Canadian mining investments in Tigray. And that might have something to do with the Canadian government's failure to intervene or to pressure the Ethiopian government to bring about peace and to stop the military action. in Tigray. And then, as Bianca mentioned, the case in Burkina Faso, and I've commented in the media, but I think the notable thing about this is essentially the fact that the mining company was so disastrously unprepared for, you know, for it to rain. Admittedly, it rained an awful lot in a short time, but, you know, mining engineers tend to have some idea of how their own operations work, and therefore it's basically a management decision whether to have adequate emergency supplies or emergency, in this case, emergency pumping capacity to deal with an influx of water and to protect those lives. And it's just astonishing that, as far as I know, they've still only recovered 7 of the bodies of the 8 missing miners, and the mine will be closed for the foreseeable future while the Burkinabe authorities and the mining company try to figure out what happened. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you again for the opportunity, and I will pass it on.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jamie, for sharing that really important backdrop and for that really broad overview of Canadian mining in Africa and the sheer impunity that these mining companies have in the face of tremendous ecological and social disruption and the extent of it. So again, you can find out more about Jamie's critical work at miningwatch.ca. Jamie, we're looking forward to hearing more from you in the Q&A. Our next panelist of the evening, or the afternoon rather, is Filia Nwache. Filia is the head of the paralegal unit for Makua, Mining Affected Communities United in Action, which is a non-governmental community-based united front of mining affected communities in South Africa that formed in response to the need to protect the integrity and interests of the people impacted by mining. Filia coordinates Makua's social audit report, which will be released on the 28th of June, 2022. Welcome, Filia. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bianca. I'd like to just start off by outlining kind of, you know, the way our laws work in South Africa, because I think that it paints a really great picture for the way in which mineral extraction is supposed to benefit, you know, mining affected communities. So in South Africa, the laws governing mineral extraction require that companies submit something that's called a social and labor plan. Now, the social and labor plan, it's a document compiled by mining companies, which is supposed to be developed through a public participation process. And interested and affected parties are supposed to contribute to the formulate of this document, right? Now, this document basically outlines the commitments that a mining company will, you know, take forward in terms of their contribution to the social and economic development of the communities in which they operate. For example, a mining company might promise to build a school or a clinic in a given community. Mention what budget they've allocated to the project and state where and how the project will be implemented, as well as how their contribution will impact the social developmental kind of aspirations of communities. And those promises are then cemented through the social and labor plan, which is a legally binding document because it's a requirement for a mineral right. Okay. So effectively, you know, mining companies are supposed to implement the projects that they say they will within a period of 5 years, and then renew their social and labor plan with completely different projects. The idea is that, you know, community development initiatives should empower communities such that they are able to challenge the conditions and structures that lead to the disempowerment of communities by increasing skills, knowledge, and enhancing elements of social inclusion, right? Development and initiatives should be sustainable, And, you know, this doesn't really take place if there are disproportionate power relations, as there would be within a, you know, giant mining corporation and, you know, traditional communities. And then community participation is supposed to inform the goals and strategies linked to that development. So as Makua and Wamua, we conducted a series of social audits, basically looking into the compliance of mining companies with these obligations in their social and labor plans. And we selected 10 mining companies to do this in, which then act as case studies for us, you know. The social audit process is community-led. It entails doing a series of community surveys, assessing the knowledge of, you know, the general community around the projects that are supposed to be implemented in their communities. As you've rightly said, we've got a social audit report that we'll be launching on the 28th of June. And I think one of the main things that came out of our research and these social audits is that mining affected communities are being systematically excluded from participating in the formulation and implementation of these social and labor plans. So I think three core themes really arose for us in this social audit process. You know, the unwillingness of mining companies to consult with mining affected communities as key stakeholders and update them on the progress of, you know, different projects that are due to be implemented. You know, secondly would be a widespread lack of compliance by mining companies with their legally binding obligations to implement socioeconomic development. And third for us is a lack of political and regulatory oversight and compliance monitoring. So none of the mining companies audited undertook a process of public participation in the formulation of any of their SLPs, which means that there's a fundamental exclusion of communities as it regards their ability to self-determine and bring forth the kinds of projects that they want to be implemented in their communities. So, I mean, that's a little bit strange if you think about how development is supposed to be connected to the people who it's supposed to benefit, right? And so we undertook this process to also kind of challenge the narrative by mining companies that mining, you know, is beneficial for the communities in which mining companies operate. I mean, about 90% of the participants did not know what a social and labor plan is, you know. Social and labor plans are publicly accessible documents. However, despite this first level of non-compliance, whereby mining companies are not publishing their social and labor plans, you know, it gets a little bit deeper than that. Only about 4.3% of the local economic development projects were actually seen to completion by all 10 mines. So there was only, you know, partial fulfillment of their obligations, as well as I would say maybe 70% of the obligations stated in the social and labor plans were actually never completed or implemented, right? Another thing that's really important to note is that non-compliance on SLPs and the obligations therein is not being monitored by the regulator, and mining companies simply don't fear the repercussions should they not comply with their legally binding obligations. One of the mining companies that formed part of our case studies is Ivanplats, a subsidiary of Ivanhoe Mines, a Canadian company. In their 2014 to 2018 social and labor plan, they committed to a variety of projects, four of which were audited during the social audit process. So one of their commitments was to build multi-purpose centers at economic hubs across the community in which they operate. However, there was no evidence to indicate that these multi-purpose centers exist. In fact, even in their reporting, they do say that they have not completed that project. It is well into 2022, and the project does not even, it's not referenced in their next social and labor plan as a backlog project or anything like that. A second project that we audited was the Lesedi Early Childhood and Development and a Business Center. So basically, it's a center that looks after vulnerable children. It's supposed to provide home-based care for the elderly and run programs focusing on supporting vulnerable children. Now, this was allocated a budget of approximately 12 million rand, that is. And I mean, only 5.5% of the community members were aware of this project at all, and where it's located. When we did physical inspections and did some interviews at the actual site of the project, we found that there was no business center. The center actually works as a daycare, not necessarily for vulnerable children, but for children. There is no home-based care program for the elderly. A food garden was created by Ivanplats, but it didn't end up being sustainable. Right now, it's non-functional. And the center itself was simply renovated by Ivanplats, and the upgrades were just kind of fixing the roof, providing some burglar bars, but nothing substantial that would equate to, 12 million rand being spent on the project. Another project that we looked at was a school's support program. Ivanplats identified 8 schools. In total, their budget was about 14 million rand. And one of the most interesting things about this one is because there's a daycare center that they allegedly kind of supported, right? And when we went to visit this daycare center, it's a 2-room kind of dwelling with a garage attached to it, a very small patch, maybe 1 by 3 meters long, of gardening done. And I mean, Ivanplats committed to spend 1.5 million rand on infrastructure upgrades to this daycare center. And it just didn't seem like anything was being done. I mean, the center hasn't been operational since 2020. And so the sustainability of, developmental projects comes into play there. Another thing another place rather that we audited, which was three other high schools. And there were science and computer labs, you know, provided by Ivan Plutz. However, the science labs as well as the computer labs were made out of corrugated iron. And it's not a very big structure, can probably fit in 20 people. And, you know, these schools are public schools. So a general classroom is about 40 pupils. And so the budgetary allocation that was assigned to each school, in this case, it was about 1.8 million for the high schools. And that did not reflect, you know, when we actually were on the ground seeing the project, the budget did not match with what was actually physically present. No extra classes were provided for students at these schools, but for competition that was, you know, run by Ivan Plutz, funded by Ivan Plutz, and it was only for gifted science and math students. At best, we can say that Ivan Plutz did contribute something to the schools, but because of the value committed to the projects, we would consider them partially fulfilled, because in these villages, something for 1.5 million or 1.8 million would be easily recognizable. You know, it's a very traditional community. There isn't much development there. So something with that budget would be recognizable. And we just don't think that Ivan Plutz has contributed to the socioeconomic development of mining affected communities in the ways that they, you know, present to the outside world. Our findings, you know, they speak to the manner in which mining companies do not consult communities on issues that affect their development. They do not implement sufficiently sustainable projects in the affected communities. And the profits made by mining companies are just simply not trickling down to the intended beneficiaries of development. You know, there's a systemic failure which is entrenched in, you know, some of the weak legislative measures present, but as well, just the lack of monitoring and compliance needs to be noted, because mining affected communities are really drawing the short end of the stick. They don't have access to community to information. They don't have access to the purported developmental projects as they live, you know. It's just our social audit report paints a very bleak picture of what development is seen as and how it actually unfolds. So I think I'll leave it there for now, and we'll just hear more from everyone going forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Philia. Thank you so much for sharing those key findings, and they're pretty fresh. So I definitely would encourage everybody to go to Makua's website and also to stay tuned for the full report, which will be out at the end of the month. So thank you again for sharing those key findings, highlighting the lack of accountability, lack of consultation, lack of benefit to communities, you know, lack of monitoring, lack of compliance, you know, it really goes on. And also we really appreciate you highlighting the Ivan Plutz Canadian based mine as a case study and for representing mining affected communities.
You are listening to broadcast. A webinar put together by the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute called Canadian Mining in Africa, Looting a Continent. This is CKUT, Amanda Radio on CKUT 90.3 Montreal.
So our final panelist of the evening is Yves Engler. Yves is a Montreal-based writer and political activist. He's published 12 books, including most recently House of Mirrors, as well as Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, as well as Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military. Welcome to Yves. Hold on. I'm getting a message from him that he's unable to switch on his camera. Just one second. I'll fix that for you.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Bianca.
Yves, you should be able to start your camera
Hi.
Now.
Hi, everyone. Thanks. I think that the first thing when thinking about Canada's role in looting the continent is understanding a little bit of the history of imperialism and colonialism. And I did a book in 2015 called Canada and Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, which shows how Canada really, in many different facets, supported the imperial, the conquering of the continent in the late 1800s. Hundreds, thousands of Canadians helped fight to conquer the continent on behalf of the British mostly, but also the Belgians. The missionaries, Canadian missionaries, played a very big role in the late 1800s in the sort of at the cultural level of bringing in European domination. Canadians supported, there were Canadians who were colonial governors, British governors in northern Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana. Canada supported the colonial process, opposed the anti-colonial movement, provided huge amounts of weapons. While the European colonial powers, Canadian weapons through NATO to support the suppression of colonial movements or anti-colonial movements in Africa. And then in the post-colonial period, Canada helped in overthrowing individuals like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana and Patrice Lumumba, played a very important role in the ouster and assassination of Patrice Lumumba in Congo. And so politicians that were trying to reverse the colonial process. So when we talk about Canadian mining and looting the continent, we're talking about this history of an economic pattern where the continent, Africa is a hub of natural resources that are taken out of the continent, little value added done locally, and the profits and even many of the jobs certainly at the higher end, the engineering jobs are often Canadians or so-called expatriates. So that's part of how we have to understand the broad question. Canada is a superpower in mining superpower in Africa. Something like just under $40 billion in Canadian mining investment. We often hear about China buying up Africa. On a per capita basis, Canada controls and owns far, far, far more of African mineral resources than China does. It's so extreme. I've written about how all these companies that have African names, they're all listed in Canada. So companies like African Queen Mines, Asante Gold Corporation, Tanzanian Royalty Exploration, IAM Gold, which is International African Mining Gold, African Gold Group, East African Metals. These are all Canadian companies. There's literally dozens of them that have African names, but they're actually based here. And you often reading the business pages, the Financial Post or the Global Mail report on business, it's often stories of one Canadian company buying another Canadian company, which they're buying is essentially the natural resources of some community in the Congo or Ghana or somewhere else on the continent. So it's quite extensive. And as Jamie mentioned, this is not just a private enterprise affair. This is state backed, right? The Canadian government supports the mining, the mining firms, Canadian companies specifically, and the mining industry. Basically, they support not mining per se, but profit-oriented mining, which is invariably Canadian companies are do well by. So when they promote mining in Ethiopia, even if it's not directly, we're just promoting Canadian mining companies in Ethiopia by opening up the mining sector in Ethiopia to foreign mining companies, invariably Canada is going to do well by their Canadian firms are going to do well by that because they're so dominant in the sector. And the examples are kind of endless. Just recently you had the parliamentary secretary for the Minister of International Trade, Arif Virani, who participated in launching the Canada's reception at the big mining conference in South Africa, the Mining Indaba conference. Canada, the Canadian government financed Burkina Faso's Chamber of Mines to participate in the mining conference in South Africa. We talked about the eight miners who've been lost, died in Burkina Faso. It's really interesting to see the Canadian ambassador, her reaction. The only mention I could see of Leanne Herman, Canada's ambassador in Burkina Faso, to this tragedy was a tweet that she tweeted out about having a dinner with a Canadian, the CEO of Fortuna Silver, and some other mining officials in Burkina Faso. And she tweeted out, "On a most difficult day for Canadian mining companies in Burkina Faso, it was a pleasure to meet with Jorge Ganosa, CEO of Canada's Fortuna Silver, to learn more about their Rocks Gold mine operations in Burkina Faso and commitment to responsible business conduct." So the only mention is a most difficult day for Canadian mining companies. That's the reference to the fact that the escape hatchet, or whatever you call it, where they the chamber where miners can safe if there is some sort of catastrophe, that it was found empty. So she tweets out about a most difficult day for Canadian miners. Nothing about the actual individuals or the families who died or at this point weren't certain dead, but who were lost. This most difficult day, and announces it with Canadian mining companies, with meeting with the CEOs, not with the families, not with actual miners, but the those who are making the profits. And so this is just a small sign of how deeply integrated Canadian diplomacy is with expanding the interests of mining companies and the mining sector. I would argue that at least a dozen countries on the African continent, the main thing Canadian diplomats do is advance the interests of Canadian mining companies. It's dozens and dozens of countries around the world, mostly in Africa. And how they do this is, this is endless. They arrange meetings between local politicians and Canadian businesses. They organize conferences that are associated with mining sector. They lobby for our mining sector reforms. They go to mines, and often controversial mines. They'll show up at some sort of ribbon cutting ceremony at a Canadian mine. Often, even if the company is displaced a local community or been involved in human rights violations, they'll often tout the company's corporate social responsibility policies. The Prime Minister, when traveling in Tanzania, for instance, meeting with mining company executives, when African leaders come to Ottawa, even to meet the Prime Minister, often the question of mining interests is raised by the Canadian Prime Minister and other top officials. Canada's been involved in helping rewrite mining codes, invariably to benefit foreign miners. Funded geological data to enable mining in general, which generally, again, usually benefits Canadian corporations. As Jamie mentioned, Export Development Canada finances, provides financing and insurance to Canadian mining companies. The Canadian Trade Commissioner Service is a big player in advancing Canadian mining operations. In 2019, the head of the senior vice president of the Mining Association of Canada, Ben Chalmers said that the Trade Commissioner's Service plays a pretty big role. Trade commissioners stand behind us and give us the additional credibility that being associated with the government of Canada abroad brings, right? So directly, you know, providing a diplomatic cover to Canadian mining companies, all kinds of aid projects that support the mining industry financed by our aid agency, Zimbabwe School of Mines, recent announcements, aid, tens of millions of dollars devoted to projects like, quote, West Africa governance and economic sustainability in extractive areas, the enhanced oversight of the extractive industries in Francophone Africa. Those are recent aid projects by our aid agency. They often finance the corporate social responsibility projects of companies. So a $4.5 million grant to London for Africa, which operates in a number of West African, it's a mining company that operates in a number of West African countries. A $5.6 million aid project between NGO Plan Canada and IAM Gold in Burkina Faso, which was really designed to pacify local opposition to the mine. Example in South Africa after Placer Dome in the early 2000s laid off a bunch of miners, the Canadian Aid Agency put up $1.4 million to basically help in lessening opposition to the mining company for having laid off many workers. At the macro level, the Canadian government channels aid to countries that have significant Canadian mining investments and uses it as a lever to support mining in those countries. Jamie mentioned it a bit, the whole question of structural adjustment. And the Canadian government was a major player in the late 1980s and through the mid 90s in promoting structural adjustment policies across the continent. And one of the things that the structural adjustment policies pursued by the International Monetary Fund did was open up countries' resource sectors to foreign exploitation. And hundreds of millions of dollars in Canadian aid via the IMF went to supporting structural adjustment programs, and tens, probably into the hundreds of millions of Canadian aid went directly to supporting structural adjustment via the Canadian Aid Agency, that our projects, aid projects, became dependent on countries following the IMF calls to open up countries to foreign investment, to reduce royalty rates, to allow for foreign exploitation of natural resources. And this benefited, this was direct benefit, this directly benefited Canadian companies, right? In Ghana, Canada played a really important role in late 1980s structural adjustment and put all this money into this project to pacify opposition to the structural adjustment program. And the major beneficiaries of the structural adjustment was Canadian mining companies. In Zambia, with the Canada in later in the 90s pushing for the sell-off of its copper, its publicly owned copper company, and Canada through the consultative group, actually they held up $530 million in loan to the Zambian government until they fully privatized the copper. And major beneficiary of that was First Quantum, Vancouver mining company, and Canadian companies more generally have been done very well in Zambia. And the copper sell-off was at ridiculously low rates, right? The Canadian company purchased the publicly owned assets for a fraction of their value, and billions and billions of dollars was extracted from Zambia through the 2000s, with the country receiving almost nothing in terms of royalties and taxes. And if you look at the numbers, you know, in 1989, when the structural adjustment period begins, and then today, you go from about $230 million of Canadian mining investment in Africa to now it's about 36 billion. It varies a little bit each year. So huge, we're talking about 150-fold or more increase in mining investment. So Canadian companies very much benefited from structural adjustment. Now, Canadian companies in recent years have become quite worried that there's going to be a reversal of the neoliberal policies, and there's going to be a, you know, push for resource nationalism. So what the Canadian government has done to support mining firms is to push foreign investment promotion and protection agreements, FIPAs, all across the continent. And Ottawa has signed or negotiated these accords with 20 African countries. There is basically, there's very little African investment in Canada. So a FIPA is only protecting Canadian investors, right? It's not, you know, Uganda doesn't have significant investments in Canada. Canada may have investments in Uganda. So there's, you know, Ugandan investors not being protected by a FIPA for their investments in Canada. So it's very one-sided. And it's really about locking in the neoliberal reforms. They're usually last for 16 years. So if a government signs a FIPA, future governments are restricted in their ability to go in a different direction. And what a FIPA does is it gives the company the ability to sue the local government in an invest in an international tribunal for lost profits. And some of these FIPAs have been done in ways that are, you know, really dubious from a democratic standpoint. So, for instance, in Burkina Faso, Canada had negotiated a FIPA with the Blaise Compaoré, who was in power for, I think, about 25 years, the dictatorship. And then there was a popular uprising that ousted him. And the Trudeau, the Harper government signed the FIPA with the interim government that was supposed to be just a caretaker government. So locking in all future governments for a decade and a half with a government that didn't have any pretense of electoral legitimacy. So this process is really much designed to undercut popular protest, to undercut pushes for resource nationalism, or even to undercut those who just want the resources to stay in the ground, who don't want to be extracting the minerals. To get a sense of how extreme Canada's support for mining in African countries can be, the example which Jamie mentioned a bit, but I go into a little bit more of Barrick Gold in Tanzania. This is the Canadian company, the most controversial Canadian mining company, in a country where there's dozens and dozens of people who've been killed by their security at their North Mara mine. There's all kinds of human rights violations alleged by the company. And in 2016, 2017, there became a big controversy in Tanzania over unpaid royalties and taxes by Barrick Gold. And it was a top news item in the country. Well, the Canadian government went to bat, the Trudeau government, right? This is Trudeau was supposed to be, you know, less pro-mining than the previous Stephen Harper, went to bat for Barrick Gold to the hilt. A couple of weeks ago, the Globe Mail Report on Business released had a front page story about part of this based upon internal government documents. The story was titled, Canadian Foreign Aid was Discussed During Barrick Tax Dispute in Tanzania, Internal Email Show. So the Canadian government leveraged its aid to Tanzania, fourth biggest donor to Tanzania, on behalf of Barrick, and putting pressure on the government to not demand Barrick pay unpaid royalties and taxes, and to put pressure on the company, the country, to come to some agreement with Barrick over the matter. They talking points in this file, in the internal file, show that the Canadian High Commissioner was prepared to talk about Barrick's human rights record and to say it had, you know, improved. So they were defending this horrible human rights record of Barrick Gold at North Mara. Again, dozens, everyone agrees, dozens and dozens dead. Some estimates go as high as 300 killed at the mine over the past decade and a half.
Well, that wraps it up for this week here at Amanda Radio, CQUT 90.3 FM. We want to thank the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute for their tremendous work and for bringing these issues and keeping them highlighted, and encourage you to go to foreignpolicy.ca to see the many, many things they're involved in. They are prolific. Stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium. Africa unite.
90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Swanee Parolpopolo is back, and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Swanee is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Swanee happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places, and, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out swaneeparolpopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7th and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m. The Swanee crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.
KUT Radio, and you are listening to the Jazz Segment with Hanzo the Bullfrog, coming to you live from the pond. Today I got a wide assortment of dope tunes from different producers, musicians, and artists that I know and don't know as well. But